Hey everyone, welcome to the Psych to Practice podcast, your one stop for practical and useful clinical information, masterful insight from experts in the field, and a guide to daily living. I'm Ray Krisner, and with me,
Paul Wagner.
And today is our first Masters in Practice episode for 2024. Yeah. And a new take for us, because we talked to two authors of a self-help book, which we haven't done before.
The title of the book is Getting Unstuck from PTSD. We had an opportunity to talk with Shannon Wiltsey-Sturman and Stephanie Losavio, and kind of going through the process for writing the book and really the functional use of the book. And it was an interesting take because the book itself already does that so well. So we got this like double duty of like, you know, we got the good stuff from the book, and then we got the good stuff from the process of how the book was made. And it was just such a great conversation.
Yeah, I agree. And it was really an enjoyable thing. And I always like to hear people's take on content and how they talk about PTSD and the idea of recovery and, you know, the word stuck, and unstuck, how that kind of fits into that recovery mode. Was really interesting. And, you know, for those of you who aren't familiar, with our guests, Stephanie Wiltsey-Sturman, she's an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. And Stephanie Losavio is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. And, they wrote this book with Patricia Rasek. And again, the book is titled Getting Unstuck from PTSD, Using Cognitive Processing Therapy to Guide Your Recovery. So, Paul, before we get into the interview with our guests, what was your takeaway today?
Yeah, earlier on, we were just talking about I think it was maybe even our conversation about what CPT is. And, I wrote it down that it was, the goal is not to take away negative emotions. It's for emotions to match the facts. And, you know, as so often, I think that, you know, in therapy, there can be that perception of coming in of like, you know, I want to fix this. I want to challenge, I don't want to feel this, but really, especially when we talk about trauma, that's not really the goal. The goal is to experience it more accurately. And when we're, you know, grounding our thoughts in the facts, like it allows us that opportunity to experience the emotions really in getting what we need out of them, but not then getting stuck on them. And so, you know, it was such a great quote there. So I just wanted to share that because it jumped out to me.
Yeah, I think it's a great jump out point. And I think, you know, there's other talk about the other emotions in that conversation, which was, I thought, wonderful. And, you know, for me, it was really a simple comment that was made and something I love when concepts are made real simple. And, you know, one of the guests said that, you know, it's this idea to help people tap into their inner wisdom. And just that was a great quote. You know, it really is this idea of getting people to really rely on themselves to process through it. We're along the journey with them, but it really is getting them to process it on their own. So yeah, I think it's just a great quote. And always, for those of you listening, we'd love to hear your thoughts. And if there's any things that you have, join us on social media or shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you.
And with that, we hope you enjoy this Masters in Practice episode, Getting Unstuck from PTSD.
Shannon and Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us on the Psych to Practice podcast. We appreciate you taking time tonight to chat with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So, we're kind of excited. Despite the fact we've done this for a while, you're the first guest that have a book that is more patient-centered or client-centered. So it's like a self-help kind of model. So this is a little different for us because we've kind of approached this a little differently. So we're kind of excited. So you are bringing a different content to us tonight. So that's great. So, when we start our podcast, we always like to ask guests just a few questions to kind of get an understanding of who they are. So, maybe we'll start with you, Shannon, but, we want to kind of hear a little bit about what got you into working in the mental health field to begin with.
Yeah, it's hard to say because I think for as long as I can remember, it's the area I wanted to go into. Like in college, I had a brief foray into maybe I should do Russian literature. And then I quickly realized I should be reading it and not studying it. But other than that, I've always just had an interest in people, how they relate to each other, how they react to different situations, and the area of clinical psychology and working with people to help just alleviate suffering was really always pretty compelling to me.
Great. And how about you, Stephanie?
I'm glad you said that, Shannon, because I have a very similar answer that whenever people ask me about like choosing to be a psychologist, I feel like I never really chose it. I feel like I was a psychologist since childhood and just had to go through the process of earning the degrees to actually call myself a psychologist. But it was always who I was someone who was, you know, paying attention to people and keeping, you know, diaries of, you know, data. And it was just, you know, who I always was. And it was, at the same time, it was hard to find like exactly where I fit in my career. Even, you know, at the end of grad school and going into postdoc, I wasn't sure exactly what my career was going to look like, but it was always in psychology.
Wow. That you know, it's interesting. As we talk to psychologists, we always get this like, oh, I wanted to be this and it changes. So it's interesting. Both of you kind of had that direct path, which is kind of awesome. So
yeah, I think if anything for me, the surprise was that I ended up going into a research direction as well as the clinical. I would have said, oh, you know, I don't think I want to be a researcher. And then it became, well, maybe I'd do things to support research, but I don't think I would actually do research. And now it is, it's a big piece of what I do. Although I love the well-roundedness. I mean, I think this is one of the things about clinical psychology is you can, you know, you can do clinical work, you can do training and supervision, you can teach, you can do research, and you're just prepared to do so many different things. And you can, in theory, you can ramp it up and ramp it down at different points in your career. Although I think once you get into a track, it's a little harder to, to pivot sometimes.
Yeah, it's great. It's nice to have that kind of balance. And so what inspired the two of you? And I know Patty Rasek was part of your book as well. What kind of inspired you guys to write Getting Unstuck from PTSD? How'd that come about?
I think it had a lot to do with just how hard it is to access treatments, access any kind of treatment, but access PTSD treatments specifically and treatments that have been shown to work for PTSD. I think we get a lot of inquiries from people who live, you know, hundreds of miles from the closest person who was trained in CPT. But they're interested. They want to get treatment. They're interested in CPT. And, you know, as much work as we're doing to train people and to try to, you know, get to a point where it's more widely available, we just knew that we weren't going to be able to get anywhere near as far as we'd like to. And there are some people who all they need is they need some help and support, but they can really run with it. And, you know, so we thought, you know, this could either be a tool to help support people as they're getting therapy. And for some people, it might be, you know, just what they need to jumpstart and get started if they can't access treatment another way.
Yeah, I agree. And we also at the time were doing other research, trying to increase the availability of treatments, tinkering with ways to make it more accessible. So Shannon was working on research to deliver CPT via a texting platform. I was working on ways to refine clinician training to make treatment clearer and easier to deliver. And so it was really a natural outgrowth of that. We had already kind of built some of the tools that would help translate this protocol, this treatment protocol, into something that is explicit enough that a patient could pick it up and use it.
I think that, I think Shannon, you'd mentioned, how hard it is to get services. And, I think having these kind of options for people, whether it's, I think, a jump start, or for some people, maybe just the right fit, maybe that's enough. I mean, it more and more, I hear in, we're here in Pennsylvania, wait lists that are 12 to 18 months to get in. So, I think creating these kind of resources just have such a value. And, I think what kind of got us curious about the topic was, I don't see much of it around PTSD. And reading a little bit that it's come out of a treatment protocol in what you wrote, I think such a unique fit. So really excited to talk about it.
And I have to say, Shannon used the word well-rounded earlier, and you were talking about the field, but the book, I think, really also does come across as very well-rounded. And as going through it, I found myself, there was those sections where it's kind of like that stop and check in, and those, what are we're anticipating thoughts that might be there. And here are some maybe responses, as well as just the general use of it. Like, I think the introduction does a great job of talking about the specific use of CPT for PTSD, but also acknowledging, some of the other just challenging life stressors. And, while there isn't necessarily that strong basis of research that says it's effective, anecdotally seeing the connections there. And so, after reading through the book, I think well-rounded is a something I would put on there. I wrote the term comprehensive down earlier, but I think I would add well-rounded into that as well.
Thank you. And I think we really wanted to create something that could functionally stand in for the therapist. Yeah. So we had to really kind of put all three of our collective consciousnesses into the book and think about all the things that we might say to someone who was sitting in the room with us. And we had to try to make it fit across a lot of different trauma types. So sometimes we, a lot of the book, we address people in general, because so much of the themes of PTSD are quite common across different traumas. But we also tried to say, okay, you've had childhood physical abuse. I wonder if, you're really stuck on thinking it happened because you were bad, or you've had interpersonal violence. I wonder if you're really stuck on, thinking it must have been something I did and I should have left sooner. So really trying to put more in there so that anyone who picked it up could see themselves in the book.
Yeah, I think that we also used a lot of what we all do a lot of training and clinical supervision and cognitive processing therapy. So it was a lot of, when you do the training, it's kind of, well, if you encounter this, here are some things that might be important to do. And we had to translate that into, if this is happening for you, kind of remove the therapist as the intermediary, and just take it directly to the, to the individual who's getting the, who's trying to do the treatment. So that was kind of an interesting thing. In some ways, we all felt at the end like we'd kind of put in all the types of things that we want to tell people when we're training them in therapy, because we thought, we're not going to be working with therapists who get stuck somewhere. We're going to be working with clients, individuals who are getting stuck as they try to do the treatment, and they're not going to be able to call us or go on a listserv or something. So we've got to try to just put everything in. The other thing that was happening is, we actually got together and wrote the book towards the, it was in the summer after COVID. So 2021, we all sat down and wrote it together. And, over that year, and even in the year while we were editing it, or editing after we did that first draft, more things kept happening in the world. And we said, we need to have some stuck points for people who are maybe refugees or who experience this kind of thing, and medical professionals. And so we were really trying to make it as comprehensive as we could.
I certainly think you captured that. And you know, we're talking about, you know, PTSD, CPT, and I guess maybe if we're kind of jumping into it a bit further, you know, hoping if you can both kind of talk about with the book, how do you both conceptualize PTSD and like really what are we talking about here for maybe some of our clinicians that if they're picking up the book and looking at it?
Yeah. So I would say that PTSD is what happens when people get stuck in the recovery process. Most of us in our lifetime will experience a traumatic event. Most of us will experience multiple traumatic events. And for many of those, we can recover without therapy. But when people have PTSD, something got in the way, something is keeping them stuck, the trauma continues to haunt them. So in thinking about why do some people recover and others don't, something that seems really important is that people have an opportunity to really process their experience, to feel their emotions about what happened and come to some kind of acceptable conclusion about why did this happen to me and what does this mean that it happened. And part of what can keep people stuck in PTSD and prevent them from getting to do that processing is if, you know, there's avoidance going on, which totally makes sense because nobody really likes to sit and feel their most negative emotions or remember the worst things that have happened to them. And sometimes it doesn't even start as avoidance. It just starts as not really having an opportunity. Like if you were, you know, in a household with violence, you maybe just had to put your head down and survive for a while. Or if you were in a war zone, you might have had to do another mission the next day. So you don't really have that chance to make sense of this experience and make it a part of your history. And so it stays with you and continues haunting you over time. So, you know, we think about recovery as being needing to go back and figure out where we're stuck in that event. Usually that involves having to make sense of why it happened. People often get really stuck with why did this happen to me? Was it something that I did wrong? Could I have prevented this in some way? So the way I conceptualize PTSD is that that tends to be pervasive because we want to believe that we have control, we have power, that we can prevent bad things from happening to us. And so saying, you know, I could have prevented it, although that might make us feel really guilty, it also allows us to keep feeling like we have control over what happens to us. And it can be really painful and uncomfortable to sit with that reality that we can't control and predict and prevent all bad events from happening to us or our families.
Yeah, I think the other thing that comes out of avoidance is that sometimes people, they make sense of it in one way and then that's it. That's the story. And because nobody wants to go back and think about some of the worst things that have ever happened to us. There's not an opportunity to kind of let the whole picture in, the whole context. So some people, sometimes people take on a lot of the responsibility when there were so many other factors that could have come into play. Or they, you know, they focus on one specific aspect of the incident and said, well, it happened because of this. You know, it happened because I was too friendly. And so I gave them the wrong impression. Or sometimes it's something like, well, you know, my mom should have protected me from, you know, the person who was abusing me, which, you know, might not be untrue, but maybe there were lots of other factors that were going on. And there's not a lot of processing of the fact that, well, there was actually an abuser there who's directly responsible. And so, you know, by helping people kind of look at the whole picture, we're giving them an opportunity to really process what happened and come to a place where they can kind of accept the full reality of what happened and experience all the emotions that come from that. And then the emotions are, we use the analogy of a soda bottle. A lot of times, all of these strong emotions, if they're just bottled up, when you first open them, you know, they're going to be pretty strong, but then they kind of, once you have the experience of really feeling them, they settle down a little bit. And the memories, everything's still there, but it's just not as, it doesn't have the same hold on you.
And, you know, there's actually, I have all my notes from when I was reading through the book here, and there's a quote, I think it was pretty early on, but it was when you change what you're saying to yourself, be more balanced and factual, your emotions will change and you'll be able to move forward in your recovery. And like, I think you both were expressing that, you know, beautifully as you were sharing that conceptualization, as well as talking about the importance and significance of processing. And, you know, we're talking about CPT or cognitive processing therapy and, you know, wanting to hear how that really functions. But also, I guess we talk a lot about CBT here on the podcast. And so if you both wouldn't mind for our listeners, kind of what's the difference between CPT and CBT? And, you know, we can then get into the way that it's utilized, but what are those pieces that really stand out as differences there?
Yeah, I think CPT is, it is a cognitive therapy, predominantly cognitive. There are some behavioral pieces, but especially to somebody who does a lot of behavior therapy, they're like little b behavioral. And so it really, it is more cognitive, but there is a heavy emphasis on the emotional processing because it's so essential. And it's not, I mean, you know, I was trained in CBT and trained with Tim Beck. And so and Socratic dialogue is like one of my favorite things to do and think about clinically. Like when you see the way that it kind of helps people tap into what they know themselves, it's really, I think, extraordinary. And I think that one of the things that CPT does, that if you have a kind of a misunderstanding of CBT, it might be surprising, but it's actually very consistent across, you know, all the cognitive therapies, is when you're using Socratic dialogue, when you're looking really closely, it's not just like, we're going to catch people in the logical errors. And then they're going to see that like, oh, you know, they shouldn't have thought that way. And they're going to feel better. It's really much more about helping people tap into their inner wisdom. And it's much more of a collaborative process. And I think that the emphasis on Socratic dialogue and CPT and really helping people look at what they themselves know about what happened, about the way that the situation unfolded, about what they would expect from other people in the same situation, you know, all of these things that we do is really helping them come to a process of discover. It's not us imposing something or leading them down some path. It's really them coming to these conclusions themselves. And I think that's what's so powerful. And then when that happens, it makes room for the emotion that needs to be processed to really, instead of feeling guilt and shame and constantly kind of trying to tamp down all of these feelings that are so difficult, there's, you know, it's much more of the natural emotions, as we call them, you know, just the sadness, the grief, maybe remembering what the fear that they felt and, you know, having those feelings of sorrow for that younger, you know, that younger version of themselves that was experiencing these things. And that, you know, it's a really profound experience that I think the kind of caricatures of CBT just don't make room for.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a really important point, that people might assume that the goal is to not feel negative emotions. And that's not the case, because sometimes the negative emotions are what match the facts of the situation. I mean, it's a fact that the trauma happened to you. It's maybe a fact that you didn't have as much control as you wanted. It's a fact that this person chose to hurt you. Those are all, you know, really sad thoughts. And we wouldn't want to take that away, because that in a way might invalidate the trauma. So I think making room for those emotions that match the facts of the situation. But, you know, we do that, as Shannon said, by making room, by, you know, getting rid of the emotions that don't match the facts, you know, the guilt and the shame and the anger at oneself when, you know, you didn't have all the control, or that wasn't your intention for that outcome to occur. So yeah, I think, you know, CPT, cognitive processing therapy, is just a really specific form of CBT. It's very trauma focused. You get right to the trauma right away. You keep it pretty focused on the trauma throughout treatment, because, you know, that's the conceptualization, that's where the patient is stuck. And a lot of the here and now everyday problems stem back to interpretations about the trauma that, as Shannon said, you know, when you're not letting yourself think about it, you don't see all the facts. So a few Socratic questions can go such a long way in helping them, you know, remember these details that change the whole meaning of the event.
Yeah, I think maybe another slight difference is that you know, when I do CBT, something like anxiety or depression, you can work in the here and now. And, you know, you can go for kind of low hanging fruit, you know, so something that we hear some people with PTSD say a lot is like, I can't trust anyone. And, you know, that seems like an easy thing to kind of do some cognitive restructuring around and make, you know, help people get a little more flexible. Like, well, maybe there are some people I can trust more than others. And when you're dealing with trauma, trying to do that first is just not going to have the same impact as doing it after people have dealt with the kind of initial, you know, the trauma related, you know, why the trauma happened and what it means for them. Then you can kind of go in and start doing those things. But if you try to do it too soon, we find you just don't get anywhere. So, you know, some of the things that might seem like an easy win early on in therapy and CBT, we wouldn't go to those things first when we're doing cognitive processing therapy.
Yeah. And I think that that's not inconsistent with CBT. They don't label the cognitive distortions or stuck points, you know, the same way we do in CPT, but, you know, you don't in CBT in session one go after someone's core beliefs. You start with their automatic thoughts. And you've got to, first of all, like build some credibility, build some mastery in how do I do this process. But in the case of PTSD, the conceptualization is usually that those bigger beliefs actually are related to some of the beliefs about the trauma. So to Shannon's example, if someone's thinking like, I can't trust anyone, I'd be really curious, you know, do you think the trauma happened because you trusted someone? Now we're getting to the heart of the PTSD, and that's going to have these downstream effects on those broader beliefs about trust.
And, you know, that having read through the book, this next question kind of feels almost odd to put out there, but it, you know, for those individuals that are maybe like, oh, you know, a book that's geared more towards self-help, how much help can this really give me when I'm talking about these really, for some, maybe like feels like a foundational moment or, you know, a moment that say, I can't challenge this for myself. How is this book going to do this for me? But really, I think it does a great job of talking exactly about those points of CPT and laying them out in a way that is functional. And so I guess as you were both, you know, part of the writing process here, how do you visualize the book doing that? Like, what are the pieces of CPT that it really generates, and how does it translate it from, you know, as clinicians sitting down across from someone, really, and just someone picking it up and utilizing it as that self-help tool, really working to ask some of those Socratic questions for themselves and challenging some of those belief systems?
Yeah, I think, you know, we try to get rid of, you know, some simple things. We tried to get rid of jargon and try to just explain things as clearly as we could with, you know, without any assumption that people would have had a background in what trauma was or anything like that. So we really tried to start from basics and explain things as conversationally as possible. We try to provide a lot of encouragement because, I mean, one of the things that is a challenge when you're doing something like this without a therapist is that there is something really important and powerful about having somebody there with you as you work on and process and think about these really difficult things. And, you know, we wanted to help people feel encouraged and feel like this is something that they can take on and do themselves. And there are going to be tools to support them, but that it is going to feel hard. And it doesn't mean that there's something wrong if they're struggling in different places. So I think we tried to provide, you know, encouragement. We tried to be as simple as we could. There are some concepts that are a little trickier to explain. So we provided videos as well, because some people just are much more, it's going to be easier to just watch a 5-minute video than read a bunch of dense text. We tried to break things down and break up exercises a little differently than we might do in the therapy where there's a person walking them through it. You know, so we would break up the worksheets in certain places and spend time kind of showing people how to do one part and then another and troubleshoot. So I think those are some of the things that we tried to do to make it a little more digestible. There are also some things that in the therapy, the therapist would do that we actually break into exercises in the book. So for example, Stephanie developed something to walk people through hindsight bias. We would normally do that through Socratic dialogue. Now we have sets of questions that we ask people to reflect on. That, you know, because that's something a therapist would typically be doing. And in the back of the book, we actually have, you know, questions that you might want to ask yourself if you experience this type of thing versus this kind of thing, because those are the types of things that a therapist might be doing with them in session. Stephanie, what did I miss? I'm sure I missed something.
That was pretty thorough. We try to include a lot of vignettes of real, you know, examples of cases that we've seen. The sad thing about PTSD is it's really isolating, and people usually feel like they're the only ones who are struggling, when in reality, it's just not commonplace for people to talk about it. Luckily, that is getting better over time and people are more open about trauma. But just to, you know, show that, you know, other people have had thoughts just like you have after a trauma like that.
Yeah, one of the things is, as I kind of look through it, and you've kind of hit on this, is that I think one thing that this book stood out to me different from other self-help books is, I think the way the questions are framed, it does really create that Socratic dialogue. Like, I mean, when you kind of go through, I mean, they're doing it on their own, but it was something I noticed going throughout, you know, looking at how the questions are written. It really does lend for really good reflection. And I have to give you all credit with anticipating questions. Like, as I was going through, I was thinking like, okay, what would a patient ask, or what would I see? And then all of a sudden it kind of popped up in the book. So kudos to your writing process for that, because it really, as I kind of went through it, you know, reading it as a therapist, it felt like a therapy session to me. Like, it was, which was, I think, hard to do for a self-help book. And I don't think most of them are written like that. So that really stood out as we went through it.
That's nice to hear, because, you know, there's a sense that you write the book, it takes a while for it to get published, then it goes out into the ether. And you know, you don't, we gave it to people to try to get some feedback before we actually sent it off to the publisher, because we really wanted to make sure we were hitting the mark and that people could understand and use it. But aside from that, you don't really know if some of the things that you're hoping are conveyed, or that you're hoping actually, you know, you just don't know how it lands. So it's nice to get that feedback.
Yeah. And I appreciated the videos too. I thought that was another piece that I thought was unique to where you have the call outs about watching the videos. That was great. And I didn't get to see all of them, but did get to pop on and look at you up.
We've used those videos for lots of things, and it's really, actually we developed them for another project where we were trying to provide support to therapists who were learning and trying to use CPT around just how to do a worksheet, and also around some of the concepts, because again, it seems like, well, you know, if you see it, you know, or if you hear it, it sometimes just lands differently than if you read it. And then during COVID, when some therapists were actually doing treatment on the phone until everybody got telehealth all together, it's impossible. And even over telehealth, it can be pretty hard to walk somebody through the worksheet. You know, now we have it, you can screen share and things. But so those, the videos were used for that. And so it was good to be able to kind of repurpose them here. And you know, and it is a little daunting sometimes. The goal really isn't to fill out the worksheet perfectly. It's to help spark your thinking, but it is daunting sometimes for people to fill those out. So we wanted to have a tool where people are walked through how to do it and see examples so that they can go back to them and use them if they need them, because again, they don't have a therapist to do that with them.
Reminding me too of when we were having some of our friends and family members review the book before we sent the final copy in. One of my family members thought it was funny that at the end of each section we had a troubleshooting section, and she just thought that was funny, like as if like troubleshooting, you're fixing your laptop, you know. But it's like there's so many places that you can get stuck in the process. And again, just really trying to stand in for a therapist and help them in any potential place they might feel stuck in the book, so that they can keep going and get the benefit.
Yeah, I actually like the use of that word, because I when I saw that, it was I was that's how I talk in therapy. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I would have probably written it different, but I would say, hey, let's troubleshoot. So I like that part of it. I was like, yeah, but people get that. That's it's very, very very user friendly term. That's right.
And the repetition, throughout it, and I'm blanking on the specific name that was at the top of the worksheet, but just kind of the rating scale on the severity of the PTSD symptoms. And I can't recall if it was after every chapter or it was after every section, but multiple times kind of coming into that and like the value and, you know, just let's view progress. And also, where are the areas where we're getting stuck, and like that troubleshooting then being such a phenomenal place, because not only do we have like I'm feeling stuck, but we can then go back and review some of those, the scales, and being able to say, okay, what are the specific areas? And yeah, so I think again, it does a great job of connecting and combining those different pieces. And yeah, it's a great addition. And I'm hopeful that, you know, for reviewing future self-help books, we're making the same comments of it. You know, it feels like we're therapy when we're reading through it. and kind of talking about therapy, jumping over into, I guess, a lot of our audience maybe has some background with mental health, whether they're in, you know, clinicians or if they're students. And I'm wondering, what are the ways that you could see your book being utilized? Like if a client is coming in and sharing with their clinician, hey, I'm reading this, what are the ways clinicians can help to support, or also what are the ways that the book helps to support clinicians in doing CPT? And like, does it provide a more in-depth opportunity for them to review what's being talked about? Like what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think it certainly could be a companion to CPT, where people, you know, use the book to do the worksheets, and it's a review of the concepts that they would be getting in treatment. So, there's research to show that people actually remember a pretty small proportion of what's covered in therapy. I mean, there's so much, you know, and right. So I think it could certainly support in that the client can review the concepts. It's a tool that can be used during CPT. I think it can also be used during for therapists who want to brush up on concepts or something they learned in a workshop isn't completely clear, or potentially as a companion to the manual. Just because we talk about it a little bit differently, and sometimes something lands differently one way. If you read it from the manual and you go and try to do it a little bit, or you think about, well, how would I say this to my client? The book, I think, gives some good examples. I think there might be situations where somebody comes in and says, I have this book and the therapist hasn't been trained in CPT. I would recommend, trying to read along and work along through it with your client. We have workshops available in consultation, but that might not always be available on the fly, but, providing support as people do it, encouraging them when it gets harder, just helping monitor progress and supporting and cheerleading and discussing the concepts, I think, could be valuable in those cases.
And along with that, I find myself wondering, are there certain individuals that you think would struggle with using the book? And I'm trying to think of some of my maybe more resistant clients that really just try to, they hold so tightly onto those beliefs. And I'm wondering if there has been any feedback on, individuals that have maybe been resistant towards treatment previously, and if the book is a different experience for them, or vice versa, if it's a good companion, or if that would be a population that would maybe struggle. I guess, has there been any insight or conversation surrounding individuals who would struggle or even benefit more so from the book?
Yeah, I think when people are really avoidant, we talk about this early in the book, people have to make the decision that they're going to try to notice when they avoid and push through it, because, obviously if somebody's really avoidant, they're probably not going to even pick up the book that much, or they're going to, not read it for very long. So I think for folks who are really still, pretty avoidant, you know, that they would need some support.
Right. Yeah. Nothing works 100% for everyone. So, and this is really, you know, a lower intensity intervention compared to coming in and seeing a therapist every week. So especially when you, you know, reduce the intensity of an intervention, it's not going to work for 100% of people. But the hope is that it will work for a lot of people, and it will maybe reach people that can't access therapy or for whatever reason choose not to at this time. So I think it's all about finding the right evidence-based approach for the right person at the right moment.
Yeah, I think there might be some people who, you know, if they could get to therapy, they're ready. You know, they might be the types of folks who could really run with it, but they just can't. Maybe they're in school or they've got caregiving responsibilities and work and lots of other things. And if they had something like this, they could make some good progress. You know, and then there are other people that really, you know, might need a little more support. And, you know, the book tries to encourage people to, you know, if you're trying it and it doesn't feel like you're getting where you need to, you know, it might be time to see if there's an additional level of support that you can get.
I think another thing that's I think another thing that's interesting too is with a self-help book, you can really go at your own pace. And so there's probably going to be some people who go through the whole book and write in every space and they do it all in a week. And then there's probably going to be some people who they pick it up and they start and they put it away and then they come back to it. And, you know, they keep like leaving it and coming back to it, and eventually they get through it. And I know that there was someone that, you know, tested the book out for us who, when she was first going through it, she like couldn't bring herself to like write in the book. Like she didn't want to write it down. And so we actually like took that feedback and put that into the book about the importance of writing it down. But that was someone who then like, they kept coming back to it. It was like a little bit struggling to fully engage, but kept turning back to it. And that's okay too. You know, you don't have to do it in, you know, 1 hour increments, you know, for 12 weeks. It could look different for different people.
And really that approachability, I think, is such a benefit to this. And I actually, you know, Shannon, but before we were actually got started, I was telling Stephanie that I made a referral for the book to one of my clients. Their child is struggling, and just some of the pieces, it really just kind of a fortuitous timing. I was like, and we were talking about that resistance that is his child is having to seeking treatment, and really just like when the conversation comes up, it's just shutting it down and really just holding on tightly to those belief systems. And we were talking about how the, you know, for my client, like the push to try to say, but this is going to help, you know, going and seeking treatment is going to help. And it just, if the belief is it's not going to, then it's not going to. And so we talked about how finding a different way that if it's just there, you know, if it's on the, if it's in the study or on the coffee table, or even just, you know, sitting in the client's child's room, and it just get, you know, it's an opportunity to pick it up and just start leafing through it. That might then be that buy-in and that engagement. And I think, you know, the value of that compared to, you know, we were talking earlier, the wait list with therapy, it can really just be an opportunity to jump in, jump out, or meeting someone where they're at that doesn't take the shame of, like almost acknowledgement of trauma before seeking it, especially if there's individuals who are, you know, kind of like my client, feel like, I think my child would benefit, or I think someone I care about would benefit. Being able to share it, I think, is a great resource.
Yeah, I hope it can be. And I do think there's something about reading where, you know, people might leaf through and something might click in a way that, or resonate just enough to kind of pique their curiosity. And then maybe they decide to give it a shot. You know, I think when we're doing therapy, sometimes it's, you know, it takes some time before things really click or people really decide that they're ready. And yeah, I think the book being there whenever they are can be, you know, it might be that some people kind of have this, you know, pre-contemplation about it for a while, where maybe, you know, they look at the book and they decide not to buy it, or they, you know, they have it. So I'd be really interested in what people's processes are like with it, you know, whether they you know, if they jump right in or if it takes some time to really warm up to the idea of trying to work through some of this, because it is daunting and, you know, then it's a lot for somebody to do on their own. But, you know, hopefully for the people that feel ready or people who feel like they, you know, they want or need to try something, you know, it's an option.
I think this was maybe, you know, even said earlier, I think the other thing is, as I read through it, you know, when I read books like this, I start thinking about patients that I have or patients that I've had. And I've had several in therapy that they're coming in not because of the trauma. They're coming in for something else that's kind of immediate. Maybe it's a relationship issue. And while we might uncover a little bit of that in therapy, it's still difficult for them. And I really saw this as I was reading it, I thought of a few people where, you know, now I feel like there's a resource that I could say, okay, listen, we're not ready for us to do this yet, but let's use this as kind of a springboard or a starting point and letting them kind of maybe work through this on their own, which might open it up more for discussion in therapy. So, you know, as I went through it, I was like, oh gosh, I wish I had this 2 years ago. Cause I had a few people, I was like, this would have been great. Cause they were great about reading things. I could give them information. But having something that has an action to it, I think really could even help therapists really let the discussion of trauma open up a little bit for those that, you know, they kind of think that's the past and they don't see how it's affecting these other things in their life. So, yeah, I think for me, that's something I'm going to kind of hold on to is that it'd be a great way for some individuals, that I work with, especially some of the men that I work with that the trauma is really hard for them to talk about with someone. So I think it could be a good springboard for discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. If it could spark discussion, I think that could be great. You know, another thing that we see a lot is in some healthcare settings, people can't be seen every month, well, either because of their own schedules or their therapist schedules. Yeah. And if this could be something that people could be doing in between, so they're not losing momentum and they're making some progress, rather than, okay, you know, it's been 3 or 4 weeks since we saw each other, so now we're just catching up and now you're going to go and I'll see you in another month and catch up again. You know, that there's the potential for some work to happen between meetings where, you know, then you could be having discussions about it or, you know, helping them if they're stuck somewhere. That might be a good use for something like this, especially given that today a lot of people just, you know, can't be seen in therapy as often as they want, even if they are in therapy.
And there's so much valuable content, but especially that engagement piece of it. And I think the very beginning of the book, again, does a great job of talking about that, you know, addressing how, you know, the value of starting with the most challenging trauma. And you know, I know, you know, in working with clients, sometimes it feels like, well, you know, like, hey, that I can't even think about that part of things. And yet that's the most valuable part of starting with. And I think, again, the book does a great job of explaining and talking about why and what the intention is and the use of it and really breaking it down. And there's some great visual aids in there as well. I mean, actually one of the client I was referencing earlier today, you know, I didn't have the book on hand. I wasn't able to pull it up on my desktop. So, but there was a visual of the drawing of where that we're getting stuck in that process, you know, of the emotions and just not letting ourselves getting over that hump. And kind of that's where we just come back time and time again. And that was the piece. I was like, you know, if you can, this is the image I want you to just kind of go and share, because that image of being stuck just felt like so significant. And, you know, when we were discussing it, he was like, yeah, that is my child. So, you know, again, I feel like we've been talking about it throughout, but just it's such a great resource for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. And I think that's just so important, this idea that, you know, framing PTSD as being stuck, but that recovery is possible. A lot of people might assume that, you know, that they can't get better, that this is something that's a lifelong illness that they'll never be able to move forward from and have a normal life. And it doesn't erase that the trauma happened. The trauma is always going to be a part of their history, but it can really change their relationship with that trauma. It can be a memory. It can be a part of their history and just one piece of the story of their life, not the whole story.
So with our guests, we always like to kind of wrap up with a few questions to just kind of, again, kind of some takeaways. So I guess maybe Stephanie, we'll start with you this time. You know, we're called the Psych to Practice podcast. And so we always are interested in what makes people psyched to do what they do. So I'm interested, what keeps you motivated?
I mean, maybe this is, you know, too obvious of an answer, but it's, you know, when you see patients that have been stuck for a really long time and they get better, you know, and they come to life before you. And I don't, you know, whether, you know, it's seeing the patients yourself or hearing about them in consultation or cases that you're supervising, you know, knowing that this person who has, you know, suffered for maybe decades, you know, finally can go move on and live their life. Or if it's a younger person, an adolescent, that their trauma and PTSD can be something in their history and they still have their whole life ahead of them where they're now less likely to have PTSD ever again, even if they experience trauma again. And I've just seen so many patients who have been in therapy for a long time. So not all therapy is equally effective. So it's really very, you know, important to my career to be promoting evidence-based treatments, helping make sure that as many clinicians as possible are able to deliver treatments that work so that patients can recover. Because it's just such a rewarding thing to be along with a patient on that journey of trauma recovery.
Shannon, same question.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, so the thing that keeps me awake at night really is just that there are so many people that it's really hard to get access to effective treatment or any treatment, you know, and, so, you know, that's definitely one thing that keeps me going. And I think clinically, and this is something that I talk with people about, you know, when I'm supervising or, you know, when we're training is, you know, you get the question, well, you work with trauma. How do you manage, you know, how do you just manage? And you do hear about a lot of really terrible things that happen to people. But on the other hand, when you see people getting better, it sort of gives you the energy and the confidence to sort of keep going, you know, it's sort of the invigorating part and why, you know, why I can work with trauma is because I have confidence that people can recover and that the treatments can help. So I think those are the things for me.
So other than your own book, if you could, pick one piece of media for people, and it can be book, podcasts, videos, movies, that you think are important for people to watch, specifically clinicians or those going into the field. What's a recommendation you would each have?
I would say, if you're interested in learning more about CPT, there was an episode of the podcast, This American Life, on NPR called 10 Sessions. And the reporter goes through CPT in a 2-week period. And it really gives such like an amazing insight into what it's really like for patients to do this therapy. So it's such a good listen. I'd highly recommend that.
Great.
I think, well, since you asked me to just pick one, the National Center for PTSD has a really nice podcast called PTSD Bites, BYTES. That is a very, they're very brief, you know, 10, 15 minutes. And it covers a lot of things. It covers different types of treatment. It covers a lot of technology that's available to support people with PTSD. It has information and content about, you know, supporting family and, you know, just very, you know, really, really nice series. So that's definitely worth a listen.
And our last question, for if you could provide our listeners or new clinicians with kind of three gems or takeaways that you've learned in your career, what would they be?
So one thing, we do a lot of, of the evidence-based treatments that have been tested, and there, there are treatment manuals and things that are written. And I think, when these manuals were written, there is a, there's an assumption people are already therapists. They know how to do this. They know how to build a rapport and, really be there with their client. And so a lot of those kind of intangible things I think most manuals talk about the importance, but they sort of assume you know how to do it. And so I think it's just important to remember that, you can have both. You can be working through a trauma-focused treatment. It's essential that when you do this work, that you are focused on, the relational aspects of the therapy, as well as the technical elements of the treatment, so to speak. They're both important. We all know this, but I think it's worth saying, because I think a lot of times people think when you're doing a treatment manual that you're really constrained. And I think there's a lot of room, especially when you're doing Socratic dialogue, to really match to what you're hearing from your client and be, attending to and validating, what they're telling you about their experience. And so I think that's one for me. Another is, that there's kind of a balance, because on the one hand, there are many, many things that can help people with PTSD. There are several treatments that we have really good evidence for. And so it's important not to get locked into, this treatment, and if it doesn't work, it's hopeless. At the same time, it's really important to give it a shot, with one treatment before you bounce to another. Something that I think I've seen in people that I've supervised earlier in their career is the tendency to pull back a little too early, instead of maybe adjust how they're doing what they're doing, or having a conversation with the client about what's not working. There can be a tendency, and I did this, I think, early on too, where I'd bounce even within, a cognitive behavioral framework. Well, this isn't working, so now I'm going to kind of try this. And sometimes you've got to kind of find that right, that balance between giving something a real shot, but also responding and knowing when you need to maybe, switch approaches a little bit or try something a little different. And then I think finally, there's so much value to continuing to consult. We have to recognize that we don't always have all the answers, and that sometimes we need just another perspective. And so consultation, I think, is just so essential and so valuable, no matter how long you've been doing it.
Great. And Stephanie, how about you?
I'm thinking a little bit about PTSD treatment specifically. And the first thing that I would say is ask your patients about trauma, because they might be waiting for you to bring it up. A lot of the patients that I've seen who've seen therapists for years before, they didn't ever talk about their trauma with their therapist. And, it wasn't because they weren't willing to. Maybe the therapist was afraid to bring it up. Maybe the patient was afraid to bring it up. But ask them really directly, about their trauma history, and ask it in a way with kind of inclusive language, so that they, will recognize their experiences in the question. So not just like, have you ever been raped, but have you ever had any unwanted sexual experiences? So ask them about trauma. The second thing I would say is not to be afraid to confront patients about their avoidance. We really conceptualize that avoidance is what keeps patients stuck in PTSD. It can be really uncomfortable to do so, but that's really important. And we have to remember that we didn't go, tackle these people in the street and drag them into our office. They came to us for help. They came to us for our professional expertise. So, it's your job to share what you know about PTSD and share your conceptualization if you think that avoidance might be going on. And it doesn't have to be, antagonistic, but, we talked about avoidance. Do you think that any avoidance might have been slipping in this week? Do you think that might have been part of what was going on? And lastly, I would say, really central to CPT, really central to the Socratic approach that Shannon was talking about with CBT in general, you don't have to make assumptions. You know, you can ask questions, really respecting the collaboration that while we're experts in helping patients recover from PTSD, the patients are the experts in their experience. They know their thoughts, they know their emotions, they know what happened. So you don't have to pretend to be an expert. You don't have to pretend to have all the answers. Be curious. The patients have the answers within them.
Yeah. And I think if I can just highlight something there, Stephanie, I think, you know, something we haven't talked about is it's actually really important not to make assumptions. And especially because, you know, there are times when someone experiences something where we might think we know what happened and we're completely wrong. And then, you know, another example is when you're dealing with things like race-based traumatic stress. You know, people were there, they know what the experience was. And I think it's really important to, you know, make room for them to really talk about what happened and what the experience is like without making assumptions and, you know, acknowledging that there are some really, really difficult and harsh and unfortunate realities and the experiences that people have, and giving them space to really acknowledge and talk about that. You know, that's a place where, you know, you're going to be really thoughtful about your Socratic dialogue and make sure you're not making any assumptions making sure that people don't feel that you don't believe them. Because I think it's a place where a lot of times people come in feeling primed, you know, race and gender-based trauma, for example, that they're not going to be believed.
Yeah, that is great points. And I honestly, we appreciate so much you taking time to talk a little bit about your book and cognitive processing therapy. And, you know, we really, again, thank you both for taking some time out of your schedule to chat with us. And we hope other people get a chance to take a look at the book. We really appreciated having that opportunity.
Yes. Thank you both for joining us for today's episode and really getting a chance to talk about your book, Getting Unstuck from PTSD. You know, Shannon and Stephanie, if there's a place where you'd like our listeners to kind of go and follow or where they can go and find the book, where would they look?
The book is available at Amazon.com through the publisher Guilford or through any other major booksellers.
And we have some information about the book, I think, at a few different places. We each have websites. I have a LinkedIn and an Instagram account that's SW Sturman. And I think both of our websites are just our full name.com, ShannonMoltzyStermann.com, StephanieLasavio.com. And we do post information there. Things about book promotions or, you know, workshops or things that we're giving or information about research or training. So those are great places to check. And I post those on my LinkedIn as well.
Certainly hope our audience takes an opportunity to check out both the resources as well as checking the book out. If you're interested in hearing more and staying up to date with what's going on for Psych to Practice, you can visit our website at www.psychtopractice.com, as well as following us on all major social media by searching Psych to Practice. We'll be back in 2 weeks, but until then, be well, stay psyched. The information contained in this podcast and on the Psych to Practice website is intended for informational and educational purposes only. Nothing in this podcast or on the website is intended to be a substitute for professional, psychological, psychiatric, educational, or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please note that no professional patient relationship is formed here, and similarly, no supervisory or consultative relationship is formed between the host, guests, and listeners of this podcast. If you need the qualified advice of a mental health professional or practitioner, please contact services in your area. Similarly, if you need supervision on clinical matters, please locate a supervisor with experience to fit your professional needs.